You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of November 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show...
With respect to Greece, if both sides are showing sufficient flexibility, then I think we can get this problem resolved.
My guests, Mary Jezewski and Kathleen Burke, will be finding out why Barack Obama is in Europe this week and what the agenda for the White House will be in the oncoming Trump era.
I think his message was freedom. Some of those things that weren't the best things that happened were forgiven because people viewed Donald Trump as the antidote for everything that they hated about politics.
Trump's new chief of staff there. We'll also be looking at how election wins for pro-Moscow candidates in Moldova and Bulgaria will affect the power balance between the EU and Russia. And we'll discuss the legacy of Hillary Clinton and her election defeat last week.
And to all the little girls who are watching this, never doubt that you are valuable and powerful and deserving of every chance and opportunity in the world to pursue and achieve your own dreams.
That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Mary Jezewski, columnist for The Independent and The Guardian, and Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at the University College here in London. Welcome both to the programme. We're going to start in Europe, a continent with its fair share of problems, but one looking increasingly puzzled at what's going on in the US. Barack Obama is touching down in Greece today, where the outgoing US president is looking to ease that nation's economic woes. He then heads on to Germany, where he's expected to try and reassure European leaders concerned about Donald Trump. Trump's been busy this weekend too, appointing some top positions for his White House team. They include the chairman of the Republican National Committee, set to be Trump's chief of staff, and also Stephen Bannon from Breitbart News Network, who will be Trump's chief strategist. Mary, let's start with Obama. We say he's coming here to try and soothe some nerves. There's not much he can do, really, is it? What can he say, that Mr. Trump isn't so bad after all?
Well, he can try that after what looked like a very uneasy meeting in the Oval Office last week. But I think there's, in some ways, it'll remind the Europeans of a very different sort of presidency from the one that they anticipate with Donald Trump. But I think also, you know, when I look back at Obama's legacy generally, I'm quite positive about it. But when you look at the relations that he's had with Europe, I mean, Europe never seemed to be at the top of Barack Obama's agenda. And so there's quite a lot of irony in the fact that now he seems to be making his farewell trip to Europe to soothe nerves, when actually he wasn't really as much of a pro-Europe president as Europe maybe had hoped.
Well, he did say, though, that Angela Merkel was his closest partner during his presidency. Do you think there, here's a woman who is concerned definitely where Europe's going to go, Mary. Do you think that there he will find an old ally who, and the both of them, will kind of regret what's happening?
Well, I think they will. And in a way, the congratulations message that Angela Merkel sent to Donald Trump was almost a pointed lecture in European values. I mean, I found it quite, in some ways, the most interesting and the most extraordinary of all the congratulations messages that Donald Trump received, at least publicly. So I think maybe that Merkel and Obama found common ground in the sense that both of them take quite a deliberative approach to policy. They neither of them come over as rash. The biggest complaint made, the biggest criticism made about either of them is that they hedge, they take a long time, they seem indecisive, maybe they come across weak internationally. So maybe they have a sort of mentality in common. But I also think if you're looking at it parochially from the British side. What's interesting about this visit is that first President Obama is going to Greece to talk the economy, and then he's going to Berlin for a big gathering of all the European leaders, including the British Prime Minister. And then he's taking a brief stopover in Paris to go to the APEC meeting. He's not coming to London.
Kathleen, let's take the parochial point of view. We're sitting here in London. You know, Theresa May is caught in a difficult position. You know, she's got to catch up quickly with Mr. Trump and seem to be on the same page because she's leaving, she's pulling this country out of the EU. She needs friends and partners. But the message that she's been giving today, which she's been giving a speech saying that the future of this nation is all about free trade and responsible free trade. But we have Mr. Trump saying, we need a bit less of this free trade. We need to be isolationist, protectionist, defend America. Do you think they really have a common shared point of view?
Well, they're both sitting out their stalls here, of course. Trump has been self-contradictory a lot. I mean, he believes in trade if it's going to benefit America. He doesn't believe in free trade if it means that steel gets dumped. Well, this isn't very surprising, nor does the EU. I think it's difficult for Mrs. May. She's a newcomer. She has the instincts of a home secretary, which is to close in and put up barriers. She doesn't know the people abroad. She is focusing down on the UK, not on Europe, not even on the transatlantic. On the other hand, it was in one of the major newspapers reported today that the British government has had an official embedded in the Trump campaign. And therefore, the idea is that unlike what has been called by Farage, that in fact, the British government knows rather more of the new officials, of the new political class than anyone might expect. And the point of that in this particular question is that they probably have a decent idea of what Trump is likely, the direction he's likely to go in. No one knows. He's contradicting himself. His officials are still contradicting each other. And it's all in a swamp right now. No one knows what's going to happen. But the pragmatic comments coming out of Washington, the somewhat soft comments coming out of London, the bombastic comments coming out of the British Foreign Secretary are at least pro-America. So I think on the whole, the British government is, one might say, pragmatism personified. And they will make what adjustments are necessary.
Pragmatism, an air of calm, everyone trying to talk things into a better situation. Mary, but Stephen Bannon's appointment, the New York Times today is saying, the man is regarded even by many allies, supposed allies in the GOP, as an outright racist, and that this is the normalization of anti-Semitic and racist views right into the heart of government.
I think, you have to say that this comes from the New York Times, which is a liberal northeast, even though it's got a very international outlook. Nonetheless, it is a northeastern, metropolitan, cosmopolitan newspaper, and to an extent, they would say that, wouldn't they? But I also think, let's look a little bit on the brighter side at the moment, that is not the only appointment that Donald Trump has announced. He's also announced his chief of staff, who is this very senior and establishment Republican, who is regarded as a pragmatic, I want to use that word again, politician, and somebody steeped in the establishment who is not really ideological, at least not in the way that Stephen Bannon is. So I think maybe I remember somebody was referring last week after Trump's election and saying that rather than have a sort of administration, at least in the past, Donald Trump has something like a court. And I think if you look at it, at least at the beginning, a little bit like that, what he's done is appointed two very different people, different temperamentally and different politically. And in a way, it'll be for them to fight things out inside the Trump court. And so I think the idea that Stephen Bannon will have the field all to himself is probably, at least we hope, wrong.
Catherine, your take on these two first key appointments?
Well, the thing is, what Priebus knows, of course, he was the chairman of the Republican National Committee. He has strong relationships with the governors, the senators, the congressmen, from the national point of view. Because remember, there's no one real Republican Party. There's a coalition of 50 Republican parties that only come together when there's a presidential election. He doesn't know Washington. Bannon doesn't know Washington. The man who knows Washington, of course, is the vice president. Vice president-elect, and Trump is going to have to depend on Mike Pence to do the sorts of Washington maneuvering that really Reince Priebus doesn't really have either the experience or yet the personal knowledge to be able to manage to quite the same effect. Without Mike Pence, I do think in Washington, Mr. Trump would be in graver difficulties than he's likely to be.
Yeah, now, we make no bones about, you know, we sit in a city like London, you know, it's a multicultural city. We feel ourselves, many of the people in this company, to be certainly centrists. But, you know, the fallout from this, and the concern, you know, today we had Mr. Trump saying, you know, don't worry about it, you know, there's no need to go marching, it's all going to be fine, I'm going to be the healing source. Let's just stick with you, Kathleen, first of all. Do you think there has been an overreaction, or do you think actually those on the centre and to the left are correct that this is going to be a devastating period for civil rights, for equality in America?
Well, I think we have to differentiate between assumptions and what's likely to happen. I think right now, yes, people are extremely worried. The racist attacks upon little kids have increased in various of the states. The assumption that the real America has actually now reemerged. There's been a lot of comments to that sort. Finally, it's the real America, not all these other lesser breeds without the law, in Kipling's terms, I suppose. And I'm not surprised at the protests. After all, Trump's backers protested an awful lot as well. One might say that's the American way. And I'd rather they protested in the streets than sat home and just brooded. At least there's a catharsis involved there. Things will settle down. Things have to settle down. There's not going to be an uprising. There's been a peaceful transition, unlike what some foreign people outside the country assumed, possibly hoped. So I think things will settle down and have to settle down.
Mary, I guess one of the interesting things is, and you use these words yourself just now, you were like, when we were talking about the New York Times, you say, well, you know, they're cosmopolitan, they're urban, they represent the educated. You know, part of, you know, the strange, the ugly thing about all this conversation is, you know, it has created this sense of a division. But, you know, part of the American dream in the past was that those words were not, you know, sectioned off from the whole of society. The dream was, you know, you could get a job, you could live the American dream, your kids could go to school, you could get education. Yet they would become, you know, educated. They'd be proud of their education. They'd be proud of their sense of getting on with their neighbours when they moved to New York. They went to these amazing cities that were kind of, you know, where all life happened. Is part of the fight back for the liberals is to kind of re-embrace these words and stop them being insults? Because that's the strange thing about this moment. Everyone's feeling, you know, times have changed in a way that there will be no rowing back. But in fact, you know, we've watched Reagan, we've watched, you know, all sorts of people come and go. And for the liberals to fight back, I wonder if those words that we're now almost using as dirty words, they need to be embraced and say, yes, do you know what, my kids have got an education, I fought for it. You know, yeah, my kids do get on with their friends at school who are of a different race. Yeah, my kids do get on with their friends whose parents are gay. There's an embracing of that that needs to happen.
Well, I think that's true, but I think it may be a bit early for that. Because in a way, Donald Trump represents something both the same and different in the sense that he, to the people who voted for him, it wasn't just the sort of things he said, but the success, you know, another sort of American dream, if you like, that Donald Trump represented. And I think that you can't really say, you know, that part of the American dream is not valid, and the other part of the American dream, diversity, melting pot, everybody getting along, everybody having a chance at education, everybody bettering themselves, that this is, as it were, a separate part of the American dream. Where I think Donald Trump is, whatever he really thinks and whatever he's going to put into effect, I think that what he has, if you like, against him, and what, you know, if we talk about the coastal, metropolitan, cosmopolitan, diverse, all those things has going for it, is the demographic, that America is becoming more diverse. And the interesting things is the social conservatism, the abortion, the gay rights and all those things that have been such a feature of past election campaigns in the US almost didn't feature this time around, because those have now become so accepted. And I think in a way, you know, Donald Trump, he's 70. Okay, he's been a businessman, not a politician. I think that the demographic of America is against him.
We're going to have to move on in a second, but quickly, Kathleen, I know that the producer wants me to move on. The last point on this, yeah, surely, you know, there is, you know, we can argue about it. Surely there is a thing such as progress. You know, you look back over the history, you know, people get more rights. We, you know, people aren't, you know, aren't discriminated against on race or on gender. And this feels like a stalling in that process, if not a kind of retrenching. Do you think that it is but a pause? And that's the thing we have to remember, is you look at the direction of American history, in the end, people are beginning to get better lives in the sense of their rights.
Oh, you Whig, you. Yes, I think what we have to watch, and what is already happening in the first week, is that all of these things he said he was going to do, deport 11 million, it's down to 2, and those are the criminals. Obamacare is going to go out the window, but no, some parts are going to be kept. Several of his most important, most mobilizing slogans or promises have already been rolled back. And so I think that it will be interesting to see how long his own supporters will continue to support when he's not doing what they want. But what he's doing, it's been one step back, but there's going to be 2 forward.
Well, we'll try and watch his slow shoe shuffle, as it were. But we're going to head back to Europe now, where there were another couple of elections in the past few days, which have seen 2 pro-Moscow candidates win in both Moldova and Bulgaria. But what does this mean for Europe and its relations with Russia? And what does it mean for even America and its relations with Russia? Mary, how important do you think these 2 votes were?
I think they're not super important, but they are important because on the one hand, they reflect a process that we've seen elsewhere in the former Eastern Bloc, where people have become disillusioned with the sort of Western way and have reverted to at least looking more equably at Russia, which was considered really the bogeyman before. Having said that, I think it's also slightly wrong. You know, it's very easy to shorthand to say pro-Moscow or pro-Russia candidates have won. I think it's more that they are candidates who take, as it were, a more realist view of Russia, that geography dictates that we have to get along with these guys rather than, and that our countries maybe they're not quite ready to be orientated completely to Western Europe. And so I think it's more about realism than it is about zooming back into sort of Soviet era. At the same time, of course, the signal that it will send to Russia is that the European Union's attempt to give attractive terms to former Eastern Bloc countries hasn't been as universally successful as maybe all the events in Ukraine led us all to believe, that there is still an attraction, not least economically, in looking a little bit towards the east.
Catherine, it's funny that the winner in the Bulgarian election, Ruman Radev, he's won on an anti-migration ticket partly, and here we are in Europe, kind of in the UK, voting against being members of the EU because we felt too many Bulgarians were coming here. So everybody's kind of, you know, blaming each other's movements. But again, picking up on the same kind of the Trumpism as well, this migration issue is at play as well as kind of relationships with Moscow, it seems.
Well, but Bulgaria, it's the other way around. They've lost 2 million to the EU of, you know, some of the most energetic and clever and young. So they'd quite like them back. I think the Bulgarian, Moldova, we can't be surprised. It's not part of the EU. It's had Russian troops in an enclave for years and years. It doesn't really have a lot of choice if it's going to get out of its extreme poverty. It's a little place, and I will not be surprised if it meanders into. Bulgaria is different. Bulgaria has a new president who says, you know, he's flown Soviet jets, he graduated from an American air school, but he's a Bulgarian general, and it's not going to be international, it's going to be what's happening locally. It's part of the EU. That's more of a difficulty, I suspect, for the EU than it is for Bulgaria. I think Bulgaria is actually in a better position at this point than it has, not least because he will become important in the EU to soften relations, or at least to try to facilitate something with Russia, which very few of the other Eastern European members, East Central European members, wish to do.
Trump and Radev both solving the problems with Moscow. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Mary Dzhejewski and Kathleen Buck.
Travel in comfort with the help of the Monocle Shop. It's the place to select the best bags, passport wallets, travel guides, and, of course, the latest issue of the magazine to entertain you on your lounger. We have a great lineup of special collaboration bags with Porter in Japan, including the new Overnighter bag, ideal for a city weekend trip. And then there's the limited edition Remova multi-wheel, made from lightweight polycarbonate in a special Monocle edition. Visit our stores in London, New York, Toronto, Singapore, Tokyo and Hong Kong, or shop online at monocle.com. Be the one turning heads at the luggage carousel.
You're listening to Midori House, still with me, Kathleen Burke and Mary Dzhejewski, carrying on the debate even without you. The think pieces will be arriving thick and fast over the coming days about what position Hillary Clinton will assume in the US's cultural history. A theme that appears to be emerging quite early is that her image as a feminist icon is actually assured. And perhaps this might be the quality that we remember most, rising above the ugly political race that she eventually lost. Let's remind ourselves of some of the outgoing words Hillary had to offer young Americans in her concession speech.
To the young people in particular, I hope you will hear this. I have, as Tim said, spent my entire adult life fighting for what I believe in. I've had successes and I've had setbacks, sometimes really painful ones. Many of you are at the beginning of your professional, public, and political careers. You will have successes and setbacks too. This loss hurts, but please never stop believing that fighting for what's right is worth it. We need you to keep up these fights now and for the rest of your lives. And to all the women, and especially the young women, who put their faith in this campaign and in me, I want you to know that nothing has made me prouder than to be your champion. I know we have still not shattered that highest and hardest glass ceiling, but someday someone will, and hopefully sooner than we might think right now.
Well, there's a woman they said couldn't do a good speech and couldn't connect with an audience. Mary, you know, As a campaigner for women's rights, do you think that she stands the test of time?
Well, I think she will do. And I think it's unfortunate that in this particular campaign, she was presented and there was really no choice. She came over as the establishment candidate because, you know, she should have been the one who was, you know, as she said, aiming at shattering glass ceilings. She was, even 8 years ago, she was on the anti-establishment side, and her misfortune there was to be campaigning in the primaries against America, the Obama, who became America's first black president, who was maybe even more against the establishment, the established order, than she was. So I think we will maybe look back at her more kindly because of what she stood for. And, you know, she did have a problem that she wasn't God's gift to campaigning. It seemed that every speech until her last, you know, nothing, in some ways, nothing became her like defeat. The way she responded and the words she used, you know, if those become her political obituary, then that's really no shame, I think.
Yeah, I think an extraordinary, extraordinary speech at the end of a grueling campaign. Catherine, again, as a feminist icon, as a woman who kind of in the end managed to, you know, there eloquently explain why she cared so much. Again, the same question for you. How important do you think she is?
Well, you see, I think she's very important. I've always thought she's important in the sense in foreign affairs, in an ability to carry a first-class brain and ability to negotiate, ability to cross lines. She was an extremely good senator. Both Republicans and the Democrats could work with her. She was a very good Secretary of State. She had links around the world. One does wonder what you have to do in the United States to achieve as a female. You can be the aide-de-camp, but never be the leader. And I only hope, it's hard to know to see what sort of woman can make it through the assumptions that, good as they are, they aren't quite as good as an available man. I don't know. A feminist icon, yes, but I think her government career is going to emerge as better than we think of it now.
Mary, you know, we get this impression of America, corporate America, you know, government in America, you know, the tides are changing, you know, that women are very successful. They have begun to get, you know, greater equality in America, and, you know, you would never say certain things to a woman in a workplace in America anymore because you'd be, you know, dragged before some tribunal, rightfully. But here we have the view that, you know, a man who said, you know, he, you know, grabbed women by the genitalia and they had no chance resisting him is now the president. And we know that 40% of the people who voted for him. Do you think that we, like much of, you know, this campaign about the right, we have misunderstood feminism in America? And in fact, a lot of women in America don't care about it.
Well, I'd like to say two things about that. The first is, I think that it was extraordinary how there were almost zero comments in Britain when Theresa May became the leader of the Conservative Party and Prime Minister at one stroke, because she was the second one to do it. It was simply not remarked upon. What I'd like to say in relation to America is maybe, I mean, I feel slightly awkward about this with Kathleen sitting opposite me.
Go for it.
But I felt that for the time that I've spent in America, and I'm married to an American, that it's no coincidence, really, that feminism began in the United States, because I found that attitudes to women, even in the late 90s and the early 2000s, were incredibly conformist. Once you got outside the centres like New York, like the West Coast, like maybe even Miami, what you had was a very conservative, very established, very fixed view of how a woman should behave, what a woman should do. And you were back in the Hillary objecting to being, you know, I'm not going to be baking cookies. And I think that's, you know, the extent to which that still persists in middle America is... I think maybe in Britain and in a lot of Europe, either it never existed quite to that extent of conformity, or it's changed. And I think America is taking a lot longer to change.
We're going to give you just a second to come in here, Kathleen, as well. You look a bit saddened by that. Do you think that actually a lot of women don't care about feminism in America, and actually they're quite happy to trade some of their rights to elect a man like Donald Trump.
Well, I was just remembering when I was not quite a teenager, and I was very much of a tomboy, and I was told I should stop hitting home runs when the boys were there because it wasn't ladylike. So I agree fully with what Mary has said. I don't know. I can't even remember your question right now because I'm so overwhelmed by the situation. Do you remember in 19th century Victorian Britain, it was pretty awful too. So they had freedom before the Americans did. Perhaps the Americans will catch up on feminism to what Britain has now been able to achieve. Two female prime ministers. We don't even have yet a vice president.
Well, we do have two great women guests who have been, I think, kind of running the show, at least here today. My thanks indeed to my guests, Mary Jajewski, and also to Kathleen Burke. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. The show, it was produced by Tom Hall. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Judith Serra. And our studio manager was Antonio Fernandez. More music next. Then at 1900 hours, it's The Culture Show with Mr. Robert Bound. We'll have more on the day's main stories, and that's on the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours London time. Don't forget, every show can be downloaded from iTunes or from SoundCloud whenever you want it, whenever it's convenient for you. But Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. And also, there's an episode of The Foreign Desk live here in London tomorrow at Midori House. You can buy tickets online. Make sure you come up. We're going to be discussing Mr. Trump and what he means for you. But from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you and goodbye.